I believe that Solomon wrote this book in spite of the fact that all liberal students of the book and many conservative students of the book who are well reputed do not feel so. But I believe the testimony of a Solomon is the only way that this book can have power. The testimony of some unknown scribe who takes the role of Solomon would hardly have any ethical strength behind what he's saying, because he would not have experienced these things. At least we do not have any knowledge that he experienced these things. And if he writes to us as though he is Solomon but doesn't want any of us to think he is Solomon, then of course it's rather futile to do that. Interesting device, but I don't think the biblical writers would do that. Let me tell you this, that I understand that in saying that Solomon wrote the book, I am presuming that Solomon repented. Because though this is not an expression of Solomon's repentance, Ecclesiastes, it certainly reflects a man who is penitent and humble before God. I know that Manasseh did it in the latter part of his life, who had lived an absolutely horrible life, whose involvement in idolatry and immorality and violence was so great that finally God said, because of it, I'm going to bring the nation down. And yet God was able to turn his heart, and I have the feeling that Solomon's heart was turned. If he is an apostate and died an apostate, he's the only man that we know of who wrote part of the Scripture, and a rather large part of the Scripture, who was an apostate. Now, that's not an argument for Solomonic authorship, but just a thought. But the testimony of a Solomon is significant because no one had the power or ever will have more power than he did to investigate things under the sun to find out if there's anything down here that's worth everything else that will give sense and meaning to life. What he says at the beginning of Ecclesiastes, if you return there to the first chapter, he says in chapter 12, verse 8 at the end, that all is ultimate vanity. Now, this is not just vanity, not some temporary experience of futility and some momentary enterprise, but what he's saying here in this book is that the things under the sun are ultimately, absolutely vanity, futile. If you're thinking about finding something here that gives life total and transcendent meaning. Now, he may be referring, when he refers to vanity and futility, to man's effort to find anything down here. He does not believe, from the beginning of the book to the end, that life here is ultimately futile. Because he continues to refer to God throughout and to express himself in optimistic terms about the final end of things. But so far as human efforts are concerned, to find meaning under the sun, in things under the sun, they will ultimately be found to be futile. What does the writer of the book, the preacher, suggest about the origin of what he is saying? He says in the 12th chapter that these are words of truth in verse 10. And then he adds, given by one shepherd. I am persuaded that this book is inspired by God, that it's not, as some conservative scholars have said, God's inspiration of an uninspired life, which he uses as an example of what stupidity can do for you. That is not the case. I believe that the words of Solomon are the words of God. And when he begins by saying the words of the preacher, that is the same sort of thing if you turn back into the Proverbs, in the 30th chapter and the 31st chapter, that begins the words of the wise men in that place. And also Amos, I believe, has a similar beginning to his prophecy. So that I think we can understand that we're dealing with inspired literature here. What Solomon says, however, will seem, as I've said to you before, almost erroneous, contradictory, even maybe cynical at times as he writes. But he is speaking of life as viewed here and from the vantage point of human wisdom's ability to find some meaning in it. I think we can say this is true. At least I'm going to say it, and I believe it is true, that the world actually gives no clue to life's purpose. The world as we see it and as we view it provides no answer to man's ultimate longing and furnishes no resolution to the jarring contradictions and inequities that life brings. And what Solomon is doing here is simply declaring that man, by his unaided wisdom, will never penetrate the mystery that guards the purposes of God. We ought to know that. We can't even know the mind of another human being absolutely until he reveals it to us. How much more so, and as the Apostle Paul argues in the second chapter of 1 Corinthians, how much more so the mind of God? But if we're attempting by our own unaided wisdom to penetrate that, we're not going to be able to. And the interesting thing is that even when revelation has taken place, we don't know everything. Deuteronomy 29:29, how many times has that passage been cited, that the secret things belong to God and the things that reveal belong to us, that we may know them or keep these commandments. But the point I'm making is that Solomon talks about in this book things that are not explained by God. I know all of us would like life to be this way, that every morning we would start out and God would warn us ahead of time that something bad was going to happen, but explain exactly how that's going to be worked out so that it'll be all right at last. Now, that's not the way it is. So that the statements made by Solomon here are, I believe, accurate statements. And when Paul writes in 1 Corinthians 1:21 that in the wisdom of God, man by his wisdom will not know God, that's being brought out by Solomon here. The vantage point of Solomon, of course, is the third chapter of Genesis, when the world has been subjected to vanity, as Paul speaks of it in Romans 8, verse 20, when death and decay and destruction have come in the place of that grand, wonderful world that he created in the beginning. This is not the world of Genesis 2 that we live in. It's a world where much seems to be futile and where great tragedies occur inexplicably, and we cannot rationalize them into making any sense. And the only thing we can do in that situation is to trust God. All right. I think the purpose of Ecclesiastes is fairly clear, but I want to tell you, if you read books on Ecclesiastes, you'll find out that no two authors have the same outline. I mean, they're all over the map. And the reason for that is the outline is not just that exact. Now, some have said that it's a case of a spiraling set of themes that go all the way through, developing greater intensity as they go. And I think there's some measure of truth in that. He just seems to spiral back and forth through the same points that are being made. And some have compared it to 1 John, because 1 John has a similar double theme, which he just keeps on spiraling through as he gets to it. It's not the sort of outline. Maybe it is the sort of outline that I make for some of my sermons. It's not good and clear and sharp like I would like it to be, perhaps, but that's the nature of the book, and he is working with this constant jarring contradiction, and his writing has that kind of spirit to it. In the book of Ecclesiastes, I believe Solomon teaches us two lessons, and I'll just set this down now. First, the critical importance of seeking ultimate meaning and fulfillment in the Creator rather than the creation. And then, once having planted our feet firmly in eternity, we can find joy in the gifts of God, which, however temporary, do bless us in this world beneath the sun. The first thing he says in this opening of the book is a poem that's so described in Hebrew. Hebrew poetry does not have rhyme. It does not have words that sound alike. It has rhythm. And there's rhythm, I think, in this first part of the first chapter. I think there's a poem in the first part of the third chapter. I am confident there's a poem in the latter part of in the 12th chapter. And let's just take note of what he says here when he has stated his question, verse 3, what profit does a man have for all his labor when he labors under the sun? Labor, strenuous, arduous labor. What's the profit of all this? One generation goes, another generation comes, but the earth abides forever. We're like actors on a stage that never departs. The stage stays forever, but the actors keep on going and coming, and that's who we are. That's the truth. And Solomon is stating the facts of the case, that we come into this world which seems to be eternal, and we ourselves are so temporary, and that's one of the futilities of life. If we were to find anything down here that is worth it all, we will not be here to use it. So that's something we have to face. And then he continues, the sun also rises and the sun goes down, haste to its place where it arises, and the wind goes toward the south and turns about to the north, and it turns about continually in its course, and the wind returns again to its circuits, and all the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. To the place where the rivers go, they go there again. All things are full of weariness. Man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, or the ear filled with hearing. This endless circularity of natural life, he's saying, is wearisome. It may be interesting for you to know that the Greeks' view of history, unlike our own, was of a constant cycle. Or history repeats itself. Oswald Spengler was the German historian that pressed this point, that history is a constant cycling of the same thing over and over again. And the Greeks had that view of history. We don't realize that this view that history reaches for a purpose, as I've often illustrated, is an arrow shot from the archer's bow hurtling to its target. That's Bible. That comes out of the idea of God's eternal purpose. And what Solomon is saying here, if you look at the world, it just looks like the same thing over and over again. We die and go, but the earth just keeps on going through these cycles. And it's almost as if it is agonizing too, trying to reach for some end. But it's like the progress of the squirrel cage. You know, it's over and over and over again without direction. Like a man lost in the snow who just keeps on circling around and around. I think Shakespeare called it a tale told by an idiot, signifying nothing. We spend our little time here, but there's nothing achieved as a consequence of it. And that's the way the world looks. Now, we are accustomed to putting the grid of Revelation over the world we look at. And I must say to you that the Bible teaches us that there is a revelation of God in the natural order. Paul argued that in the first chapter of Romans when he said the invisible things of him are clearly seen, being perceived of the things that have been made, even his everlasting power and deity. You can know that God is powerful. And you can get some sense of the might of God by looking into the heavens. And that's, of course, stated by the 19th Psalm. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows his handiwork. And that's true. But that doesn't tell you why all this is. And it doesn't tell why you are and where you are going and what you are to be on the journey. So there's another passage, too, I think, of in the 14th chapter of Acts, when Paul is addressing the pagans at Lystra, I believe. The 17th verse is it that he has not left himself without witness, in that he has given us rains and fruitful seasons, and filled our hearts with joy and gladness. But that still doesn't tell us more. There's something that I think that is an evidence of God. It's something of God. 17th chapter of Acts, when Paul's speaking to the pagans at Athens, he says that God made the world. And he's not served by men's hands. And that he has made of one every nation of men to dwell upon the face of the earth, having determined their appointed seasons, the bounds of their habitation, that they might seek God. And the reason that longing for God may be in us, and a realization that he's more than power, is the fact that we have a sense of moral truth, a conscience within us that gives us immediately a disposition to judge behavior on the basis of whether it is right or wrong, in others especially, and sometimes in ourselves. But that is a testimony to the fact that God is not only powerful, and that God is not only wise beyond our power to conceive it, but that he is righteous and has expectations of us, but that leaves us at a loss. He is righteous, he has expectations of us. What does he expect of us? How are we to live? What is our purpose? What is our direction? The third chapter of Ecclesiastes, verse 11, is very determinative in the book. When he said he's put eternity in our hearts. You didn't ask for that. But I'll tell you one thing, you will not escape it. Human beings have to ask the question of what is life about? We are not content just to go through life like some dumb brute, eating the grass because we are supposed to eat the grass, or running about through the woods because we're supposed to run about through the woods, or crawling like a worm upon our bellies because that's the way we're supposed to do it. We have to ask the question, why? It's in us to do so. And Solomon is wrestling with that question in the book of Ecclesiastes. Why are we here? What is our purpose? What is the end of all this? How do we know how to achieve that end? Those are questions that are not going to be had by staring into the heavens. I know people can say they get out here in the Sierras or wherever else you want to go and just see God and feel God everywhere. And what they're thinking about is some sort of emotional experience which their own ideas of life are going to direct. They're getting no information from God at all. And when they get off the mountains, all they know is he sure did make this a beautiful place. But you still don't have the answer to the question, why? That's the agonizing question. And as Solomon continues here, he says in verse 9 of the first chapter, that which has been is that which shall be, and that which has been done is that which shall be done, and there's no new thing under the sun. Is there anything whereof it may be said, see, this is new, it hath been long ago in the ages which were before us. There is no remembrance of the former generations, neither shall there be any remembrance of the latter generations that are to come among those that shall come after. No new thing under the sun. We're a little bit troubled by that in this greatly technical age, because we think we have created a lot of new things. Did Solomon learn? Did Solomon fly? Did any of his contemporaries stand on the moon? Did they know anything about nuclear physics? Well, you can say all that, but I want to tell you something. The wind's still going the same course, and the sun's still rising and setting. And all the planets still moving around the sun. The sun and its planets still moving through the Milky Way. The Milky Way is still finding its course through these multiple galaxies. Let me tell you, as it now stands, we're talking about hundreds of billions of galaxies. Hundreds of billions of galaxies the size of the Milky Way, which would take you 100,000 light years to cross. And they estimate now that the universe could be crossed easily in 1 billion light years. And I know you're ready to make the journey. And what has changed? Let me tell you, our technology has made about as much an impact upon the universe as a gnat flying over it and dropping an eyelash. That's about it. And the only reason we think we know something is because we compare what we know now to what we used to know, which kind of encourages us. But if we compare what we know now to what there is to know, we are ignoramuses still in kindergarten if we've gotten that far. And we have not changed the way this universe moves. Oh, we talk about trouble with the warming inclination because we're destroying the cover that goes across there. But that is a tiny, inconsequential thing. And what Solomon is saying is far more foresightful than our narrow perspective of thinking we have really changed something. We have changed nothing. And for all our strutting up and down, what have we achieved? In matters that are really significant, all of nuclear physics, everything we know about quarks and everything else that's connected with that, what has that done to answer one iota of the question, who are you? And why are you here? And where are you going? Nothing has been answered. And that's Solomon's point. And it's weariness. Weariness in the human heart. Weariness seems to be expressed in the way everything goes on and on and on in a pointless cycling to nowhere. And then the fact that when we die, we're not remembered. I know you think you will be. You may be remembered by some member of the family who is interested in all those dry genealogies, and he's digging up the family tree, and here's your name in the list. And you'll be put in there, and they won't know a lot about you, but you'll be put in there just to make the linkage all right. And he can trace his history back to all the thugs and rascals that have been in his background. But nonetheless, no remembrance insofar as this world is concerned, insofar as life under the sun is concerned. And then he adds, after he stated again that he was king over Israel and Jerusalem, that I applied my heart to seek and to search, this is verse 12, to seek and to search out by wisdom concerning all that is done under the heaven. It is a sore travail that God hath given to the sons of men to be exercised therewith. And he says that rather frequently, a sore travail to be exercised with, a sore travail. This is our burden, that we must seek an answer to this question and seek it. If we do here under the sun, he says it's going to turn out to be futility. That, verse 15, which is crooked cannot be made straight, and that which is wanting cannot be numbered. Let me suggest a few things. I tell you, my watch is running fast today. Surely there must be something wrong with it because I've entered this time zone. But here are some things that I want to speak of with you. He mentions them in chapter 3. By the way, chapter 3, which speaks about all these times, and it's the most familiar part of the book, we think to ourselves, well, That's right. There's a time for all things, and I must seek out that time. So that I'll be sure and do that thing when in the right season and the appropriate time. He is not talking about that. He's talking about what happens to you, not what you choose to do. He's talking about the jarring contradictions of life. Birth, death, and every last one of them, the opposites, as they swing back and forth. You're pulled here, pulled there by life. Time to cast away stones, time to gather stones. I don't know how many of you are wrestling with that question. A time to rend, a time to sow, a time to keep silence, a time to speak, a time to love, a time to hate. And we're trying to figure out time to hate. And preachers have been struggling over this all the while, trying to figure out, now when is the time we're going to kill? And when's the time we're going to hate? And when's the time is it going to be for war, for peace, etc., etc.? He's saying this is what happens to you in this world of vanity. You're going to be struck with this. And all of it, he has said, verse 10, I have seen the travail which God has given to the sons of men to be exercised therewith. You're trying to figure things out in the midst of all this jarring contradiction. And he hath made everything beautiful in its time. He has done it. And Solomon, he's confident of that. I'm telling you, this is not a pessimistic book. I know this seems inexplicable, he says to us. And it's you're living in a roiling pot of constant changes and things that hurt and things that dismay. But he said, God has made everything beautiful in his time. And I think beautiful here means he will work it out. I think it's probably Romans 8:28. To them that love God and are called according to his purposes, all things work together for good. And then he says something that is very significant. He hath made everything beautiful in his time. Also he has set eternity in their heart, yet so that man cannot find out the work that God hath done from the beginning to the end. He's done all this and you can't figure it out. And if you think you can figure out what's going on by observing and looking at life so that you'll know exactly how God is working, what his principles are, what his eternal purpose is, and how this thing fits in with it, then you are badly mistaken. And why has he done all this? Verse 12, I know that there is nothing better for them than to rejoice and to do good so long as they live, and also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy good in all his labor as the gift of God. I know that whatsoever God does, it shall be forever. Nothing can be put to it, nor anything taken from it, and God hath done it that men should fear before him. You can't figure it out. You're going to have to trust God. Well, is that the answer? You mean we just live with all these mysteries and contradictions and at last we just trust God? That's the answer. It's the answer that Solomon gives over and over again in this book. What are some of those jarring contradictions? Let me give you a few. 3:16 says, and moreover I saw to the sun the place of justice that wickedness was there, place of righteousness that wickedness was there, all the wickedness and things of that sort go on in life. And here's another one he mentions after that one in verse 19, for that which befalls the sons of men befalls beasts, even one thing befalls all of them. As one dies, so dies the other. Yes, they have all one breath, and man hath no preeminence over the beast, for all is vanity. And of course, Jehovah's Witness has been reading that a long time, telling us that's the way it is. But you've got to remember the perspective of the preacher. He's saying that's how things are down here, so far as we know. Now, I want to tell you something. If you know more than that, you haven't been there and done that. If you know that the spirit of man grows up, it will not be because you figured that out for yourself. It'll be because you just conjectured the matter. The only reason we know it is because God has told us so. You cannot live your life under the sun without making an appeal to God and have an understanding of that. But he's just saying that these are some of the things that trouble us. Let me give you some that really trouble you. I'm skipping over several. Look at the 7th chapter, verse 15. All this have I seen in my days of vanity. There is a righteous man that perishes in his righteousness, and there's a wicked man that prolongs his life as an evildoer. You ever see that? Are you telling me it never happens? Are you telling me that sometimes righteous people suffer agonizing troubles? It looks as though they have them every day. And the righteous man over there, or the wicked man over there, all his children go to Harvard. He makes $3, $4, $5, $6 million, or maybe 100. He lives in ease. His health is good. Never has ulcers. Doesn't seem to worry him, bother him. That's true. Have you ever asked the question why James had to have his head cut off and Peter lived several years later? Of course, he had trouble at the end too. But why did John get to live like he lived? And James had to add, look at his brother. Explain that, would you please? It's the problem of Job. Why do the righteous suffer? It's the problem of the 73rd Psalm. When the psalmist says, look, I looked around and I saw how sleek these wicked people are and how they're blessed in life. And I wondered if I had just cleansed my hands in vain and for no purpose. And you know when he got his answer? He said when he went to the house of God. That's the problem here. Verse 14 of the 8th chapter, there is a vanity which is done upon the earth, that there are righteous men to whom it happens according to the work of the wicked, and again there are wicked men to whom it happens according to the work of the righteous. That is true. That is true. And you look out at life and you ask yourself, well, let me see how the righteous work, how they do. And you find out they get sick, they have terrible disease, have terrible accidents, have terrible heartbreak, and they die. And you look out the wicked, and not only do you see wicked people having the same problem, but you have wicked people that don't have that problem. And you're trying to figure out, now how should I, what does God expect of me? What does he reward? How does he reward me? Let me tell you, it's a dangerous thing. It's a dangerous thing to try to conclude the will of God by his providence. And we say, well, we must be doing good. God has blessed us. Are you sure? Sometimes God gives you prosperity to destroy you. Makes your table your snare, he says in one particular passage. So you better be careful in judging that you're doing God's will simply because you're having it easy. Nothing bad's happening. And these texts might help you. Now, if you look at this and say, well, Solomon's just as bitter and cynical as he can be, and he doesn't have it right. You can go ahead and say that, but I tell you, my experience in life is that this is exactly right. I saw a young man get cancer at age 30. He was the father of two children. His wife was weak as water, spiritually, and he was strength. And he was the strength of the family. And he died and left that weak mother to take those two boys and guide them and take them into all kinds of tragedies. I can't explain that. And I'm not going to read the Bible and explain it either. The only explanation I have is God is good and wise. And he'll work that out. And that's Solomon's answer. When you want an answer to the question of life's mysteries, you finally are not led to the answer to the mysteries. You're led to God. That's where you're led. And you're led to God and you're told to trust him. And that's all the time I've got this morning. But remember, that's what Solomon is saying. You read through the book and see how many times he tells you that God's going to take care of it. Doesn't tell you how, but it tells you God's going to take care of this. That God will judge, that God will deliver the righteous. But listen, my brothers and sisters, it doesn't happen in this life always. You've got to look above the sun. And that's the reason heaven is so important. It's the reason we need to love it, cherish it, strive for it. Because it's in that hour that God will make all things equitable, bring everything to justice, everything to righteousness. And it's in that hope that we live our lives. Thank you.